Let's tidy up this tangle of film by putting it on a reel. Here is a motion picture film, 1,000 feet, 16,000 separate photographs.
Welcome, everybody, to the official space section of the charter.
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Sir, you're out of order.
Out of order? I show you out of order!
So, first off, dude, thank you so much for coming over.
Super excited.
Hanging out in the room. I know it's a lot of shit to, like, take in at
it's
first.
It's awesome. I love it. I love it. I haven't actually spent time in it. There's so many great things, though.
It's taken a year to get this place.
Man cave.
Man cave. Man studio. I don't think there's a single space left on the wall, but I will find it.
Yeah, for sure. But, or replace something.
Yeah, exactly. Still come. Well, I can't take down the big one, the Prestige. That's my Nolan, right? Like, that one takes up the most room.
Yeah, that's amazing.
So cool. I told you that we would talk about you today, which I'm very excited to talk about. I'm always about the journey. So how did you find film? How did you find wanting to act?
Yeah, I mean, it's a convoluted thing, but I guess it all started in University of Manitoba, but it really started in high school where... I'd kind of lost my peer group that I was hanging out with, which meant that I was like doing a lot of drinking and drugs and stuff.
Translation.
And I was pushed into the arts by my teachers.
Get out of the drugs.
Right. Yeah. And we had this core group and we wrote this little skit show that we performed at Prairie Theater Exchange after it moved to Portage Place.
Okay.
And we got great adjudication, and it was just a really nice moment where I got to bond with a whole bunch of friends that I probably never would have had if I didn't do it. So there was something there. I was like, I really want to do that again. But then I went to university to take education.
What did you want to teach?
Well, I didn't know. I don't know if I wanted to teach.
Oh.
That's so funny. I know. It's ironic now. But
they never tell us how to do school.
No.
Like how to pick your life.
I just thought, okay, I really adored my teachers growing up. They really kind of gave me a lot of encouragement and a path to follow, which I appreciated coming from where I did. Anyway, really, I got to University of Manitoba. I took an intro to theater class. George Tolles was teaching it. So that's kind of, this is going to be the thread maybe. And he really championed me. He thought, you know, as a first year student, I had a lot of special qualities for this business. So he'd take me aside a lot saying, you know, you could actually do this if you wanted to. So that led to me dropping, like almost VWing all of my education courses and then starting to steer by the end of that year into theater. And then the next 2 years, I took all theater and film. And then even went and auditioned for Ryerson, which is now, I forget what it's in Toronto.
Okay.
Auditioned with about 3,000 people, accepted 36 people. I got in, and that kind of changed my life. I was like, okay, I'm going to do this. So that's really where it started.
What was that process like? Like 3,000 people, I know American Idol, when 3,000 people show up, what's...
Yeah, maybe I'm exaggerating, and that's going to happen.
Still, even 300 people.
Sure. But it was mostly the greater Toronto area who were auditioning.
And GTA. Then
GTA. And then I was maybe amongst three Winnipeggers who showed up.
I knew you guys were from Winnipeg because you have parkas.
Yeah, right. Yeah, no, I guess what did it involve? It was an original thing where I had to do a monologue and sing a song. I sang a song by a friend named Aaron Peters, a wonderful Indigenous artist. He sang a song about, and now it's here today, it's called The Perfect Crime, about Indigenous children being buried.
Hmm.
It was... And I sang it, and then the first question was, are you Indigenous? And I was like, no, I'm Mennonite.
What is it? What, do I have to be?
But it was one of my favorite things. I told you that I spent a lot of time with Ryan Black growing up, and that's where I met Aaron. And so we would jam a lot. I would be invited just to be a voice in the room. And so I did this, got a call back. I had to do... I think they gave us a cold read of Shakespeare.
Oh, boy.
And then we had to come in and do an improv. And then the second callback was like adjudication of like four people.
So you've got a monologue.
Okay, yeah.
A song.
We can move on from this.
No. You got a monologue, you got a song. Then you've got a Shakespearean.
Like almost a cold read.
A cold read. And then you've got a cold read Shakespeare, which not a lot of people know, tone, cadence.
We spend like, we each got about half an hour outside to go over it and then read off the page, but make choices.
Yeah. And then you got to do an improv.
Then we have to do an improv. And I don't think any of it went well, but But
of course it did. Look what you are.
But I got selected to be there, and so yeah, I went, and I like I think that's really the nuts and bolts of it. And then, geez, there's more to it. It's a crazy little story at the beginning of my career because, in that process of going to audition, my wife and I, who were friends at the time, had like started a relationship, and she had agreed to drive me to Toronto because I couldn't even afford to get there. So we did two trips together, and in the process, we were very close.
Yeah.
And then by the time I got in and started school, I got a phone call about 3 weeks into the classes saying, I'm pregnant.
Oh, fuck. Man, your story's a movie.
I know. It's crazy. And then, so I stayed for 3 months, and I couldn't focus because, you know, that...
Yeah, that's a lot of stress.
I was, I think, 24. And so, yeah, I got to go back. So I dropped out, and I took whatever I had left of my student loan. This I tell this story so many times, so everyone's heard it, but I bought an engagement ring at the corner, the jewelry store right beside Ryerson. 2 days later, I got on a plane. I booked the Viscount Gort, and we went to Ray and Jerry's. So then I proposed to her, and she said yes. And we set a date for January 2nd because we both come from traditional families, so that was important.
Yeah.
And then January 4th, in the process, I shot a film with Guy Madden. Just a short film, and I got into a play that George Soles directed, but Ross McMillan had written. And we started. I got married January 2nd. We started rehearsal January 4th. So no honeymoon. I was starting my acting career. I got my equity card from that, and then the rest is history.
Wow.
And I stayed with it, and that means that's a roller coaster ride, dude. Where I walked away from acting at least 10 times in the last. Whatever it is now, 25 years.
That's a running theme that you hear a lot about, right? Like you go in your first dive, right? You roll up a stake, take it off, you know, going to Vancouver, Toronto, LA.
Mm-hmm. I did the Toronto thing.
And, you know, you hear about how it, like, you really got to have some armor on your soul for this one.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and for me, more accurately, because I had a young baby and then 3 years later had another one. For me, it was about stability and creating a world for my kids and knowing that I wasn't making enough money to do that from this career.
Yeah, I'm a 24-year-old, you want to be an actor. Okay, you can fall down.
Sure.
You can eat Mr. Noodles.
If,
you can
if you don't have a kid.
If you don't have a kid, right? Yeah. You can do whatever you want, but now you're trying to live a very big shared dream and be a dad at the same time.
So for me, it was really always... it bringing me back and having something a little bit bigger, more challenging come my way. And I can't be articulate about that, but I just know that every time I walked away, the forces that be just said, no, you're...
The force is strong with this one.
That's right. I am a Jedi. That's where we'll land on that one.
I got a sword up there, man, if you want to play with it after.
Well, I've been eyeing it.
Everybody asks that question too. Says the same thing. It usually was an accident. You weren't trying. Like film is a motley crew of vagabonds and travelers, and I think that's what makes these projects and the ones that we love so much stand the test of time, because it's a ragtag group of people from all walks of life who've never worked together,
right,
who now all have to lift and figure out one person's dream and get it right.
Collaboration. It's the hardest thing to learn in this business, to not be the center of the universe, but to even though we have that infrastructure within it, we're all pulling our weight. And Michael Riley, he's a Canadian actor. I'll let the people who know Canadian history, but he came in to do a workshop, and he shared this one analogy that making a film is maybe one of the hardest things to do because it's a line of people, just how you explained, who all have different artistic interests and histories. And they stand in the line and they pass this egg that's so fragile that somebody created at the front.
Yeah.
And as they pass it, everyone's got to do some kind of form of incubation, add their own spice
to it. That's good.
But I think he said a lot of times what happens in film is that somebody's ego gets involved and says, I can do this better than the last person who gave it to me. And they interrupt the process. So he said 9 times out of 10, when you make a film, by the time that egg gets to the end of the line and it becomes a bird and it hatches, it's this like Frankenstein thing that can't fly because everybody's not on the same page. They're not trying to just do the same job for that one egg. And I just thought, I got to carry that for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
Because that's really what this industry is about, is you're just coming in to put your touches on
your zhuzh from
whatever you saw.
Yeah.
And then you have to let somehow it go. Well, yeah, you have to pass it on and just hope that you didn't try to rearrange something or go against what the whole vision was in the first place. Anyway. I love that analogy.
And I do too. I kind of want to get a tattoo of an egg on me now just to remind me of this. Like
this is the thing.
That's a really beautiful way to put it. Okay, so
yeah, there you go.
So now we know how you got into it.
Okay.
When did you remember, because you say that you got a family.
Mm-hmm.
You
beautiful family, thank you.
You're shaking the dice, wanting to be an actor, postman to salesman, repairman. These are all guaranteed incomes.
Right? Sure. The accountant was the one that Christina's psychic said I should have been.
Ah.
Yeah.
Thank God.
Thank God.
But when did you go, like you say you walked away 10 times, but when was the first time that you were like, okay, this is a career. This isn't try, fail, try, fail, try, fail. This is now something that I'm...
Yeah, I hesitate to say that I ever sat down and said this is a career. But I did decide that I am going to keep trying this until the day I die, but I'm going to make my life so that I can do this and that and that. So
interesting.
Acting,
okay.
Studio, auditioning, but I also work for the city. That happened during the pandemic.
Sure.
I took a job. So I have a lot of things going on in my life that just bring in a little bit of income here and there.
Okay.
So really I decided to be.
You're in control of it.
I included it in my career.
Ah, well, no, because the age old idea of like get a career, 40 years, retire. Yeah. That's gone.
It's gone.
So
precarious work is the new way of life.
It is, because this, as much as the day job pays for all this, mm-hmm. right? So like, I don't have this if I don't have that, but at the same time, I got this.
Mm-hmm.
So like, and it's in little chunks, and it's here and there, and it's highlights, and it's what I love doing.
Yeah.
So I kind of sympathize with you in that regard, where you're like, well, I'll just make it fit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Just because you need to. Here's the thing. I've always needed to be creative in my whole life. That's always been the thing since I was like very young. I really was drawn to creativity. If it was singing and I don't play an instrument, but I tried. But art, I loved doing things that were very hands-on. And I excelled at it. So it's always been kind of something that I need in my life. I need to be creative, or else I'm not a happy person.
Okay, well, that brings me into my next question with you, because it has to do with creating the characters. So,
okay.
Is there something that you've learned that significantly helps you shape, because you play multiple characters, you wear multiple hats, things change, no two stories are the same.
Mm-hmm.
Is there something that helps you, that you rely on every time you go to develop your character?
I wrote down repetition. So that what that means is reading the project over and over again within the time that I have, just so that I can start absorbing. But there's so much more. Understanding what our situation is, understanding how I can connect to that from my own constitution, and then not betray what's on the page, because there's they always draw these like situations where this character kind of has a vibe. So if I ever do kind of steer away from my own constitution, who I am, my end goal within, whether it's 3 days to figure it out for an audition or it's like 3 months to kind of do a play, I'm always starting from that place saying, okay, I'm gonna allow that external idea to come within
me.
I'm
open to everything.
Yeah. And then the hope is by the end of it, before I present it, that me is in that. That's an extension of me. So I somehow figure out how to, I don't know, what's the venom? He's one of the...
A symbiote.
I try to make it a symbiote.
I get it.
Yes.
So you're inside of the character.
Yes.
Even as far as you have to go to get there, something's grounded in you as opposed to grounding the character in whatever contemporary idea it's in.
That's my hope. And okay. that doesn't all, I don't always succeed at that. I mean, I've done 100+ auditions where I just stunk up the room because it was all externalized, because I had no it never got close to me. And that's film is of all the mediums of art, I think film is the most microscopic in terms of like, yeah, that's bullshit.
Oh yeah, you can't get past.
I don't want to hire that.
No. What is it in that room? Like I would never want to be a fly on the wall because it's already hard enough. That clip of Ryan Gosling when he's talking about auditioning.
Yeah, I saw
it. You seen that one where he's like, you show up and you get there and you think
the everyone cowboy. In the room looks the same.
Yeah, as,
and
you brought the cowboy hat
and everyone else is wearing it.
Yeah, and then you get a parking ticket. Like,
yeah, exactly. And why am I doing this?
Yeah. As long as you've been doing it, does that ever get easier? Because everybody I've heard, they're like, you're practicing your craft when you're auditioning, right? Like, you can always put a positive spin on something, but really, truly, honestly, talking about the audition, has that ever gotten easier?
I'd have to say maybe the last 5 years, yes, but only because I went out of my way to start making personal relationships with the people who are bringing me in, who are giving me adjustments. I think a lot of the time, I've had so many auditions too where I just melt in front of people because my insecurities just come to the fore. And I can't, my voice doesn't exist anymore. I'm my choices, my ideas, I'm second guessing everything. So it's taken a minute. I think I'm a lot more comfortable in that room. The only time that I get flaky is when I feel underprepared, when I didn't give myself enough time, and here I am presenting something and hoping that they're going to still hire me. So I get a little flaky there, but you know, I'm still working. I'm a work in progress, my friend. I've done some really cool things. I'm really proud of a lot of the stuff I've done, but you know, it's, I think art should always be in a state of, I don't know. I'm a beginner.
Well, yeah, because as soon as you let the ego in, you think you know, and you're cutting yourself off from whatever you could come your way.
Well, you don't see anything through it. You don't connect. You're not present. You're not grounded in that moment anymore because all it is about you and your journey.
Yeah,
not about how this can be just another whatever step in the road that where you get a privilege to kind of be part of something, no matter how big or small. I just love every opportunity. I say yes to too much stuff, to be honest.
I mean, in the movie, it didn't work out for him all the time. But I mean, yeah, okay. Is it true that like you're just like, yeah, I can do that. Yeah, I know how to do that. Don't worry about it. And then you're like 6 months later, you're like, I'll figure it out.
Yeah. I mean, I certainly have said yes to things. So like, I fit that. I can. But you know, the truth is I say yes to more things that scare the shit out of me.
Well, you're not going to learn otherwise.
Well, right? That's it. It's like, I'm not going to be challenged. I'm not going to be stretched. And yeah. And maybe to my detriment sometimes, but I think that's something I learned from George Tolles was if you're not scared of the thing that you're trying, then maybe you shouldn't try it because you've already done it. There's no reason to try it again.
Yeah.
You're not really setting yourself up for failure, for tension, for growth. You're setting yourself up to kind of become complacent and bored. And, you know, I don't know. It just, I need to be scared. I think that's the point.
I like that, though. Like, with this endeavor, just for slight comparison, everything scared the shit out of me from the start because I was like, imposter syndrome.
Yeah. Well, right. That's it. That's the big buzz thing now. Yeah. Imposter syndrome.
It's real.
It's real. I know.
Fuck, it sucks.
And that's why I said and I think I've been doing this instinctively, but now it's out there. You always should be a beginner every time you try something. Because then that's when you're the most interesting. It's when you're the most human in the room. And then you're not afraid to connect to the guy who's got all of these credits and all of this experience because you get to be a beginner. You don't have to be a peer or an equal. You get to ask questions. You get to say hello and look that person in the eye like they're a human, not somebody who, you know, you want their autograph from.
Or, I don't think I'm going to look at acting in any other way now. I've talked to you for 20 minutes so far. Like,
good.
It's really, I'm going to rewatch a bunch of movies now.
Good. We're human.
We is there something that turns off on you? Are you there the whole time? Like, what is it? Like, I'm in my mind, I'm just watching. Okay, you gotta know your sight line. You're aware of a room where everybody is, but you've got to go somewhere where it's like the green on Sunday at Augusta, right? Where you got to turn off everybody who's there, who's all there for you, right?
Sure,
they all want you to succeed.
And that's the adjustment you have to make. Yeah.
But like, are you actively in the moment? Do you come back to it? Like,
I think that's where my experience with theater comes into play, because, you know, unlike theater, film is very intimate, and the less is more thing is a real story. I tried. I haven't even come close to mastering, my opinion, but the whole thing of the idea of a crew around you, and yes, expectations, and you know, okay, quiet on set and action, and all of a sudden it's like, oh shit, it's just us.
Yeah.
But everyone is like, literally, they could touch us. They're so close sometimes. I think for in theater, what you learn is to kind of feed off the audience, where there's expectation that you're going to be great. So you start saying your lines, you start connecting, and then all of a sudden you feel the room kind of, there's a vibe in the room. You either know when it's working, or you feel like, oh no, it's like,
yeah, that's the human in you that's telling you what's up.
I'm missing the vibe here.
Yeah.
So I think that's really what I cling to, is just to make sure that when I do come in with a performance, that at least everybody in the room is perking up, going, okay, that's working. Does that make sense?
No, it makes perfect sense.
Okay.
I was in musical theater as a kid, and I remember the moments where, like, when you know it all comes together and it pops.
Yeah.
And you can feel it. It's ethereal. It's like the water worm in the abyss. It's you just know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people who are meant to tell stories and be in front of the camera and share their way of the world through their storytelling, you know that, or you don't.
That's right?
Right, yeah. You can teach someone to show up on time, but can you teach them to be there in that moment? It either is or isn't.
And then, of course, there's the other part of that where you have to also train yourself to hate the audience. So that
why?
Well, because sometimes the audience can dictate what, because they have expectations of what that's going to be like.
You mean the world is full of assholes who are like, this is how you should fucking do it?
Well,
and then they go online and puke it to all of us.
Well, they show up with this expectation. This is how I imagined it. And then of course, but again, so this is, that's so complicated that if you, yeah. I'm really just talking about the energy of the audience.
Okay.
If everyone's engaged, you feel it. But there's the other side where you can say, I'm going to try to give them what I think they want. And then that's a mistake, because that's when you start externalizing and pushing and not being present in that moment. You're trying to amp things up to make sure you're getting the laugh, or you're getting people to feel.
You're asking for the laugh instead of asking for the intimacy.
In the moment with your fellow actor, like, let's make sure that this moment between us, even though we have all these distractions around us, let's make sure that we know what we're after. Let's make sure that what we're doing, it feels right. It feels connected. You're not looking through me. I'm not looking through you. We're looking at
we're
each
locked.
Other, and we're creating.
Yeah.
We're creating this, and it doesn't matter if it's... We can change it up if we need to. We can make adjustments.
What's that? Is there a high that's comparable to that that you've found in your life? That's suitable for the public.
I did go to Yellowstone recently, and I had a few moments out there where I welled up going, wow, this is kind of, this is untouched. This is really beautiful.
This is the last part of America that hasn't been drilled or fucked,
right,
or sold or whatever.
Yeah, well, partially. They have enough commercial inside of that too, but yeah.
There's a whole fucking show about it.
So there's that too. I really love to get out and see the world if I can. Which I can't, because I don't make a lot of money.
Do you watch life for things in moments that you can be like, I'm going to pocket that and use that for later? Or when you come up with when you're presented with a character, you said the repetition part to get into it, but do you, if you're going to be XYZ character, do you go and experience XYZ things?
I did at the beginning. Yeah. And I think it was kind of, I probably did bad things to myself in order, because I think that's one thing when you're connecting with characters and you're going to these dark human places.
That's what I'm talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. I think certainly I absorb it all the time when it happens. And, I think I just, I'm not as cognizant as I was when I was a younger actor. Because I remember as a younger actor, I felt like I'd use everything in a performance or in a production or something. And then maybe would go seek out more damage in order to kind of stay
in the moment,
connected with that stuff.
Yeah.
Because that's the one thing when you have a performance and you're connecting with something, after you've used something that you really felt and you went there, the next time around it feels, it's almost like that well is dry. It's like there's nothing in there anymore.
I was going to say, and then maybe you're like, okay, like the damaged comedian who's got to go out there and, you know, have
find
the
more
hard
material.
Find more material. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, I understand the Hunter S. Thompson route of it, right?
Sure.
You can get fucked up, you can go gonzo, and you can do it. But, I mean, now you're bordering on, like you said, your own, it's to your own detriment.
Yeah. And I'm not getting younger.
No. Less cells to spare.
Yeah. I want to be around for my grandkids, you know what I mean?
Is there a role that you had a hard time coming out of?
Yeah, it was Joe Keller.
Tell me about it.
Give me 2 seconds.
Yeah.
Okay, that one hit me. I think because I'm 49, so I'm this is my 50th year. I'm a 74 baby.
For listener, this is All My Sons.
All My Sons by Arthur Miller. I did this last year.
The playwright.
The playwright. And what a privilege to be given the opportunity to do this kind of work in Winnipeg. It's rarely done. And if it is done, it's done at a professional level. And typically, they're only hiring a few kind of supporting roles in the city. Everything's coming offshore. But Joe Keller, All My Sons, he's a tragic character who told a really tragic lie in order to save his business and his family and his future, and sacrifice his best friend to do it.
For a listener, just give him the Coles notes of it.
Just during World War II, Joe Keller decided to sell or give faulty parts to the military for airplanes. And this is based on a true story.
Yeah.
And what happened, is it 21 pilots? There's a band.
There's a number of
there's
planes.
There's a band called 21 pilots, but it's... So 21 pilots died because of these
That's
parts.
That's why they got their name. That's,
and because they're from the same place where it happened.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So, and then the story unfolds of the audience learning about all of the changes that were made in his life, that his family stayed intact. A few neighbors had been replaced, and one particular neighbor whose daughter is coming back to potentially marry my son, who was engaged to my other son who died in the war, also a pilot. Their house now has somebody else living in it, and we find out that their father was the scapegoat for Keller to save his career. And then he buried it with his wife and even kept it away from his own son who came back from the war. And so everything unfolds in the end. To the point where he has to face the truth, and the linchpin is pulled when he finds out his son killed himself because of the news of the 21 pilots dying because
of his
company.
Had he not fucked around,
if he'd taken the fall for it, or maybe even said no to it in the first place,
he'd still have his family.
It might have been different. He wouldn't have been as wealthy. He would have had to sacrifice his business and start over. But yeah. He'd
have what matters.
He made a very difficult decision.
So as someone who has a family, and obviously you've mentioned grandkids, like you, the family aspect is big for you. I imagine that was like looking into a mirror and maybe not seeing stuff that you wanted to see.
And maybe revisiting a lot of my childhood with my own father and my grandfather and the history of my family and where I came from. Because, you know, I'm not a lot like Joe Keller, but I was...
You had to be.
I was raised by a lot of Joe Kellers. Right,
they're an era of men, for sure.
An era of men, and not that my family were liars. That's not what I'm trying to say. But they were tough. They worked hard. They found ways to survive with very little means. And but in the process, they kept things away from us too. And maybe my dad might have been somewhat abusive at times. And so again. I warned you, this is too close. And maybe I don't even want this in the podcast, but this is my therapy session with you, and that's it, Michael. This is the end of the interview. I gotta go.
Safe space, man.
It's totally I know it is. It's good. So I think I really started inhabiting a lot of my dad's qualities to find this character, and in the end,
that's incredibly brave of you.
It was, and it kind of broke me, but in a way, it brought me closer to my own father. Taught me to respect a lot of his choices that he made because they were difficult.
They were of a time.
And it's, you know, we inherit what we were given from our own parents. You know, we try to evolve. We try to get better. We try to improve the situations that were bad. But at the end of the day, that's it in a nutshell. That's what we're given to work with.
You do the best you can with what you got.
And you hope that you get more exposure from the world. But validation doesn't come easy from outside people because they're all building their own pyramids. So anyway, that's to the point is that was the one role that I went so deep with. And I'm so proud of that work that we did as a collective. It was just a beautiful realization of a very challenging play that's from the 1940s. And I think we've found a lot of beautiful nuggets out of it. And so coming out of it, I went back to a city job mowing grass and picking up garbage after getting 7 standing ovations. So my,
hey man, you got to live.
Yeah, so my validation was on like an all-time high, and it went to like the lowest of the low of like cleaning up after people in Winnipeg, which I don't mind doing, to be honest. I really don't.
Well, no, I mean, it's probably humbling.
It's beautifully humbling, and I love working outside, and I love working with the people that I do. They're all a bunch of wonderful human beings. Anyway, it was just a moment where I was doing this, and I was like, where did I turn that corner? That I said it was okay for me to to do this, and I don't know if it meant I didn't take a real job or I survived this acting career. I don't know. I just had this midlife crisis moment, and I turned off the machine that I was operating in the middle of this field of grass, and I think I had an anxiety attack. And my face was leaking. I wasn't crying or anything. I just got my whole body got swollen, and I had tears. I couldn't stop them. I just was leaking.
That's the big cry that feels so good when you're done.
I guess so. It changed a lot of things. It made me make a lot of decisions. I'm still in the process of that change. But anyway, I'm no different than who I was. But when you ask that, that's a trigger for me because that's the role. That's the role that I was like, I was meant to do this. So why didn't I just...
I am incredibly, I mean, I knew it happened. I knew you were in it. I feel like like knowing what I know now about what you put into it, I would have loved to have seen that. Mm.
I didn't want anyone to see
sure,
that.
Okay.
Fair. Oh, you mean all my sons. I thought you meant my anxiety attack.
No. That's yours. That's you. That's all you meant. I get it. I'll be there when you're done for a beer. But knowing what you called into, knowing like, and that's the thing that I told you about that I get my, you're fucking going to make me cry now, dude.
Okay, good. Well,
it's therapeutic for both of us.
Never bringing an actor on again.
No, I'm not. You get too real. But no, my experience with film was a Layson father who had a giant collection and a huge flat screen TV, but no regard for me. Mm-hmm. So I would go and visit him on my weekends with my father, and I would have Dr. Zhivago and The Godfather and Taras Bulba, mm-hmm. and all these big films from his childhood that I would never watch him with. So I would forget where I was, and I would be taken away by storytellers. So my crush on your talent is being able to go to a place that's rotten, mm-hmm. excuse me, that is for me, the audience, for me to experience and to have a conversation about and walk away from. But at what challenge to you, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody who came to see you is walking away absolutely entertained and...
Well, devastated.
And devastated. Yeah. Sorry. Entertained.
Entertained, but and then shockingly devastated.
Yeah, broken, yeah, right? Yeah. You know, it's not a happy ending.
Yeah.
But... they will walk away and they will have no idea what you went through to get there to perform that. And that's what I find so interesting about an actor is that you do that again and again and again.
Yeah. Yeah. Why? That's a good question. I don't know.
It's got to be getting shit out, I imagine, you know.
As an instructor, I always tell people there are therapeutic qualities to acting, but it's not therapy.
Sure. I'm sorry.
It only complicates it. It really makes it worse.
Well, because you're becoming another person and not dealing with the shit that you might need to deal with.
Yeah, you're inhabiting something and going, okay, well, I channeled it. And I'm going to make some changes going forward, but I might have paid attention. I brought it out and put it on the shelf for some stupid reason.
What does every actor need? What's one thing that to make a, maybe not a great actor, but just to make an actor better?
Confidence to be themselves. Confidence to put themselves out in the world. And finding a way through it, because I think everybody's got a quality that belongs in front of a story, but I think a lot of times we second guess ourselves, we sell ourselves short. Again, imposter syndrome.
Listen to the little voice in your head.
We never allow that voice to be quiet. We always allow that voice to have superiority over us. So I think the big thing that I've been doing lately, I don't know if it's working, but I think it is. And this was after I did All My Sons and had my little episode. And this is, again, listening to a lot of self-help stuff. I stopped caring about validation. And most importantly, from the people that I held closest in my life, my own family, I tore up all the contracts with them and said, I know I've done all this for you, and I know I've probably kind of filed that stuff up because I didn't get the return, so I have all these, like, IOUs. And I said, they're all done. I've just ripped them up. We're going to start clean. You guys can do what you're going to do. I know you guys got your contracts against me.
It doesn't null them. It just...
But yeah. I just needed to... So it's validation of your own worth that you have to give yourself every day and say, yeah, I had a good day. I did a lot of cool things today. I got out of bed and I achieved. Whether it's big or small, it doesn't matter. It's really about you stopping expectations of validation from others. So I think, again, this is confidence for me. This is you waking up every day saying, I'm doing the shit that I want to do.
Yeah.
And I'm gonna go hustle for it. I'm gonna go hustle to get myself out there. Understanding that there's a lot of doors that are going to close on me. It's fine. That's the thing. It's confidence. It's a belief in yourself. When you have that and you walk in a room,
it's palpable.
People see it. They do. This is what they hire. They go, okay, that, and then you're making strong choices. You have your own voice. Your creativity is kind of opened up. So, you know, and here's the other thing about talent. I think a lot of talent comes from not what people prepare. You can certainly strengthen skills, but really it comes from you getting out of your own way and just saying, hey, I'm just going to, whatever comes to mind here, I'm throwing it out there. It's what's happening right now.
I love that.
I'm not going to filter, because that's where people are really engaged. That's when actors become truly brilliant. And I'll guarantee you that no actor is going to sit down and go, yeah, I thought about that. I planned that. That was, I decided that 3 months ahead of time so that when we got to camera.
Yeah, don't own it. You found it in the moment. Let's leave it a miracle.
And here's the last thing I'll say about that.
Say more.
Okay. No. But this is a Guy Maddin thing, and I'm going to bring this up at the workshop, so that's my first kind of segue. But
it's perfect.
Doing an auditioning workshop. Guy Maddin's a special guest, but he said this while we were shooting, I think it was Cowards Bend the Knee, which is one of my favorite projects I've ever done in terms of, like, Guy and I were just, we were two peas in a pod. I was playing him, he was directing, and we had so much fun.
You played the guy that was directing you.
Yeah. It was magic. Anyway, Cowards Bend the Knee. It's a really... you should check it out. Everyone should. Anyway, he said that if you can find three, like, brilliant moments, inspiring moments within your storytelling. So while you're accumulating all of your footage and everything, if you can have three incredible moments where you're like, oh, I'm an artist. Everything else or surrounding those three moments is forgiven.
Yep.
And that becomes a masterpiece because of those three moments.
Yeah.
So if you can remember that for everything you do, always seek out those three perfect moments that you do not have control of, by the way. These are moments, they're happy accidents, they're just moments of inspiration that happened in a moment. If you got three, you got a product. Is that good?
No, it's perfect.
I loved it.
It's the rule of three.
The rule of three.
By Darcy Fair.
It's, well, I'm pretty obsessed with that. That's my secret, though.
Okay.
Now it's out in the
world. I'll cut it. Don't worry about it. Listener, you mentioned Guy. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So let's just get into it. Like, you've had the acting studio. You've been teaching for 16 years,
16
I think.
16 years now.
What is it that you have found that you love about teaching?
Yeah. Well, a lot of things. I keep getting excited about it. There's been challenges, you know, there's students that you work with where you're like, oh, I'm never going to get through that person. Maybe I went too far with that one. But then there's so many more where I'm like, we just opened up something there. That was incredible. And then I get to be the person who got to be like the go-between for that. Of just kind of saying whatever I needed to say. I work so much in the moment, but I know that I have this ability just to kind of like mold myself to what people are working with, their insecurities, mostly because of the stuff that I recognize in myself.
That's a strong sense of empathy.
Right. And so I see people have these epiphanies, these moments, these breakthroughs, and I go home feeling like I've achieved something really important, and you being creative and you having that permission in your life to put out an idea that you created and have people receive it. And they can receive it any way they want. This goes back to validation. They can say yes or no, but because you got the opportunity to do it in your life, your quality of life, I believe, is like 10 times better than it would have been if you decided to say, I can't do it.
Yeah, no.
Anyway, that's where I come from. That's what I teach. And then within that, I have an infrastructure where I pull out all these scenes from what I think are great films. I've allowed some of my cohorts to bring in some slock, and I know I can see that you're a fan of some of it. But
does my room pass your test?
Yeah, it's close. You'd love to meet Jean-Jacques Javier. He talked ad nauseum about things that just relate to that elephant there. I don't know. Anyway, I stopped doing it. I think I did it for 1 year at Prairie Theater Exchange. I was getting like 6 hours a week and getting paid like, I think it was $30 an hour. It wasn't chump change.
Yeah.
But, you know, 9 hours a week is not going to feed anybody, including myself.
No.
So I threw it away. And then I got an opportunity through Video Pool. We said this earlier, but
yeah, you're talking about Rebecca.
Rebecca Gibson was teaching out of a film group and she's amazing.
Hello, Rebecca.
Hi, Rebecca. So she'd walked away to do other things, but also I think she'd moved the studio. Anyway, Jeff Urbach was working at Video Pool. We worked on a short project together. He was also a programmer at Video Pool, and he wanted an acting proponent back in the studio.
Sure.
He was about to leave his job. I think he had something worth about 5 months of free studio time and credits that he'd accumulated over his career there.
Well, and all those credits.
And he passed them on to me and he said, I want you to start an acting program, see if it flies. I said, okay, I'll do it for 5 months. That sounds like a fun side project. I'm not working right now. Everyone's saying no to me. Let's do it.
Fuck it. I'm going to say yes to myself.
And then I had all these beautiful people, peers of mine, who I didn't even realize would even care what I had to, my opinion, my ideas. But they did, and they lent me their ear. And then after that started slowing down a little bit, I decided to start bringing in beginners and intermediates. And I realized, wow, there's the market. That's where people are going to continue to have a business to run. So I've been doing it now for 16 years. I've had my down months, but down months means I only have 10 students, which I still think is a wonderful month.
There's no metric.
There's no metric.
If there is a metric, fuck the metric. Like,
that's right.
This is about you and being happy and being fulfilled and doing what you want to do. So obviously my Winnipeg, right?
Yeah.
That's the one you really cut your teeth on.
Thank you, Roger Ebert.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Right? Like, mm-hmm. And probably, I mean, I think, if not the best way to explain a version of a person's Winnipeg. Like, if I wanted to say to people of the world, watch this film, will best express so many different things. If it's not in his childhood, it's in the childhood of others.
It is a masterpiece. It really is.
And it's beautifully shot. Mm-hmm. And so how does this director's thing come about with you and Guy at the acting studio?
You know what? I had a brunch with him. I bought a piece of art off of Guy because he had just shot. So this, I think this is an interesting story. He just shot Rumors with Cate Blanchett. And it's going to do great, but it's really not in the media a lot.
It isn't, surprisingly.
But, you know, as Guy always has with his films, he always doesn't take a payment. Because if he puts it into the film, if it's needed. I'm not joking. So Guy came home.
It's like the original Keanu Reeves.
Guy came home and he hadn't received any kind of form of payment from this film yet, which he did eventually. I'm just going to preface with that.
Sure.
But he decided to go online and start selling all of these collages that he made. And these are beautiful, really interesting things that he's created over the years. And there's a story behind that, but you can ask Guy. But I saw him and it was probably like 3 a.m. I was up scrolling. And I was like, Guy, what are you doing? And he said, he's saying I'm selling these to pay my rent. And I was like, well, I'm buying this one. You can't give that away. I want that. So I bought it, and then that turned into a brunch. And then we sat down, and we had this wonderful reminiscence about all of the things we've done. I think we figured out maybe we hadn't had a one-on-one like that for 15 years or something crazy like that.
Wow.
It's crazy. Anyway, it was magical. And then at the end, he's like, I'd love to come by the studio anytime. I've always wanted to. And I was like, well, I was always afraid to ask because, you know, you're Guy Madden. And then I drove home and I was like, you know what? I'm going to do this audition workshop. I'm going to bring Guy in. I think that would be fantastic. And then I messaged him and he said, yes, it's on my calendar. We're doing it. And I was like, okay.
Fantastic.
Now I have to create an ad. Damn it.
I can help you with that.
Hey, please do.
I'll send you some shit after.
Yeah, it's going to be fantastic. This audition workshop, it's a lot of me, too. I'm teaching people to kind of demystify the audition room, to strengthen their self-tape work, to give them a better kind of infrastructure. I have Carl Thorderson and Dana Leotold attached to that, too. They almost self-tape everything now, and they book so much work by through their self-tape. So I really want to know what they're doing.
Yeah, right. Like, has this become a thing more because of COVID?
Yeah, well, Jim Heber, one of our casting directors, only does self-tapes now. Carmen has people back in them. Carmen Kotick's bringing people back in the room, which I think is, personally, I like it better. But self-tapes are
you're
a real
performing,
thing.
As opposed to just looking into a camera and...
Yeah.
Like, I can't make a fucking social media video to save my life because I'm just always looking at myself.
Right.
Right? So, like, self-taping to me is just, you know, there's no... It's like a comedian trying to do a Zoom comedy show.
Sure.
There's no reaction, right? And I mean, they're probably trained to be like, thank you, next. But at least you've got something to aspire to.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, you have validation.
Yeah.
Or feedback, at least.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's tricky. But, you know, I was on the set of Miracle in Bethlehem recently,
yes.
And I was talking with Ben Ayers and Laura Vandervoort, and I was talking about this, like, frustration that, you know, doing self-tapes, I really prefer being in the room, and I'm just getting my handle on auditioning. And Ben pauses me at one point and says, dude, we're all doing self-tapes. Yeah, used to it, brother.
It's the changing of the guard, I guess.
It's the world we live in now.
Yeah.
But I'm in this process now finding silver linings with that stuff. So, for example, with self-tape, one of the things I like to say in the workshop is that you'll never have a bigger prop warehouse than your own house if you need a prop for your audition. There is something in your house for everything, and you don't have to bring it to a room, and then it's strongly discouraged to do so. I got winter-tied. I was wearing a parka and shoveling because I had a scene that I had to shovel somebody out of being stuck.
So you went and shoveled.
So I got a shovel and put a parka in front of a screen and started shoveling and performing the scene with this action. I was like, I would never do that in a room. But I booked that.
Now, okay. I'm an outsider, so I don't have industry experience in regards to the seeing the process and the professional side of it. But if I saw someone go that far to get a job, I would be like, well done.
As long as you're not, as long as the props don't become a distraction, that they're being inclusive with your choices.
Okay. Okay. All right. Okay. Fair enough.
It's important.
It can't be on the nose.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Much
it's that. Like, look at my props.
Hey, I'm shoveling.
Hey, hey. I'm clever.
I got mine at a discount. Okay. Fair enough. Wintertide. That's
John Bernard.
John Bernard. Yeah. Yes.
PowerPoint Films.
I have been bugging John for months.
Shout out to John. I just saw it recently.
Do you watch yourself?
I don't. I hate it.
I can imagine.
I avoided it, but Christina, my wife, wanted to watch it, and I was like, okay, I'll
That's like a dystopian sci-fi, I think.
Yeah, right? Yeah. It's about, you know, people are turning into some form of, like, lifeless, zombie-like creatures.
Ooh, a dig.
Yeah.
He took that around to a bunch of festivals I saw,
he
too.
He did, like, and yeah. Won a bunch of awards, and yeah, it's done
nice.
Very well. Yeah. So, yeah, that was a lot of fun. I was just a supporting character. The hardest part of that job for me was to put contacts in so I looked like a zombie. It took me a minute. They actually sent me to an optician who were giving
like
us...
properly fitted.
And showing me, yeah, properly fitted and showing me how to do it. And I think I was there for 45 minutes. And I had to, like, thank the woman profusely for her patience because I was such a baby about it. Like, every time it would just touch my skin on my eye, I'd be like, no.
Yeah, it's a no feeling.
No.
Glasses my entire life.
Yeah.
Darcy, like, I can't understand poking yourself to see.
It was like.
So anti.
And she was so calm, but she kept on saying, it's not that hard. Anyway, that's it.
We're going to touch on the new play that's coming up very shortly.
Thank you.
But I do want to ask you about improv.
And okay.
Breaking away from the page. And I mean, that to me, you've got the writer who's so married to the story because they've brought it from their brain to the life.
Yeah.
But then you've got these moments that you were talking about, these three beautiful moments, these happy accidents,
sure. Yeah,
right?
Yeah,
that are anti to what's on the page.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine that might be a roadblock at some points where, like, what you've done that wasn't written is gold.
Mm hmm.
Is there a lot of strife there usually? Is there been a moment where, like, where it worked?
Yeah.
For something like that? Like, is improv
it's
a comedy thing? Like,
it differs. Well, I think it should be called improvisation. Because improv kind of does kind of lean towards we're doing a show that's based
Names
on
out of a hat.
Games. Yeah. Improvisation in film, I encourage it in my class, but I think I've been finding the last little while that I've been encouraging it so much that actors are coming in and basically rewriting their scripts. They're like, I'm following their stuff going, not one of those words that you said is written here. So it's getting a little too liberal.
Like you can change a word at the beginning of the end, maybe?
I think changing words is totally fine. But I think this is very recent for me. I think it's important that you at least revisit the scene after you've kind of figured out a rhythm and a vibe that fits your energy that you're connecting to. You should at least go back and honor the work that writer did. And that's a theater thing, I know. Film, it's a little bit loose. I know working on Miracle in Bethlehem with Jeff Beasley, he loves just kind of like riffing and throwing lines out. It's so much fun to work.
I'm sure it is.
Yeah, it's just you do a take and he's like, okay, go again. Okay, say it this way. Okay. And then sometimes right in the middle of a take, you'll hear him at his monitor going, okay, line now. Okay, that looks pretty good. He's just shaping things. And
he's building with clay, yeah.
Tons of fun, and I total respect. So I think improvisation is a wonderful thing to have, and you should keep on working that muscle. I've never liked it, but I think that's just me because I've had kind of negative experiences in the realm of doing improv.
Okay.
And more.
So the connection, the short bridge there is...
Usually it's because of the people I'm working with, kind of like... They weren't yes and people.
And isn't that, that's the number one rule of improv,
number
right?
One rule.
Yes and, yes
yeah,
and.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's stuff that's coming up for you, again, back at Rachel Brown Theater.
Mm-hmm.
Great yeah. theater to watch.
Again, working with George Toles.
What's the play this time?
28th Minute Productions. This is The Antipodes by Annie Baker. She's a Pulitzer Prize winning author from the United States again. Maybe one of the, from what George tells me, and I'm about to kind of take this journey.
Sure.
But maybe one of the most strongest voices in theater today
okay.
in America. George loves to bring wonderful, proven work. And this is, I think it's maybe 5, 10 years old. Anyway,
I was doing a little bit of research on it. It's not an old one.
Yeah, it's not. It's very recent. And
what's the breakdown?
So okay, it's a comedy. This was important when we had our cast party for All My Sons. Even George was like, "I think this one took too much out of me. I think I'm ready to retire after that." It was like the end game for me. It was the top of the mountain, and I was like, "For me too." And then I think maybe he was just leaving this as a seed in my head. He said, but if there was a comedy you wanted to do, I might consider it. And then I got a message in November. And sorry, Christina's going to, my wife is going to listen to this. So sorry that I'm bringing you into this. I love you, my dear. We were at the cabin. He sent me a message saying, I want to do The Antipodes. I want you to play my lead. Are you in? I understand if you don't want to. And I didn't even hesitate. Didn't even talk to my wife. I was like,
yep.
I'm in. Okay. Premise. It's a writer's room. It's a group of hired writers who are trying to write a story that kind of encapsulates the end world that we live in. There's something that resonates with the audience.
How do we sell this?
I play Sandy. He has carte blanche from his higher thans because his last project was a mega hit.
Ah.
So he's brought in...
You're Orson Welles.
Yeah, yeah, exactly right. That's very good. So I've brought in a couple of my old cronies, and then we've stacked it with a bunch of new talent. And I don't want
to
give
coming to see this.
Too much away, but, you know, there's a lot of just really funny moments of me asking them just, like, to tell their personal life stories, because that's where we get our good stuff.
Right, yeah.
Yes.
Bring the insides out here.
That's right. Yeah, yeah.
That sounds like fun. That sounds like producers adjacent kind
yeah,
of.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. And 9 people in the room, so 9 actors, all with a moment. There's we don't get to leave the stage, by the way. On the other side of things, there's a storm that's happening outside. Sandy, my character's like, he's losing his summer properties. His wife is dying of something. There's all these tragedies happening outside the room. So he gets to leave, but everyone else has rules that they have to stay till they figure shit out.
Yeah, you're not allowed. We're locking the door.
So you can just imagine what it's going to be like. So The Antipodes by Annie Baker, it goes up, I believe it's May 27th, I might be wrong, to June 1st.
Fantastic.
But when maybe it's, anyway, 7 shows, and we'll probably start rehearsing beginning of May. But yeah, that's I'm really excited about it. I know this time I will not have an anxiety attack.
I can't see how you can.
I don't know if you can have more than one.
You also got something else coming out. You did. I mean, yeah. I like I said, we were talking earlier about the work stuff and how I know Neil and everybody mm-hmm. and all the amazing crew heads and talent here in Winnipeg.
Absolutely.
Which Neil come to trivia on 13th because this will be out this weekend. So come. I'm calling you out if you don't come.
There you go.
Yeah. But you did Ordinary Angels.
I did, yeah.
How was that? That was
fantastic experience. I played
such
very,
a great story.
I'm looking forward to it. The just looks so, it looks so moving. That scene that they shared with and Nancy Sorrell is brilliant in it.
But, oh, Nancy Sorrell.
Where they clear the dead and then your big man.
My big Alan Richardson.
Alan Richardson.
Fuck. I'd let him hug me.
Breaks down. And anyway, I don't know how much I can give away about this, but I play a character that has a significant assist towards the end.
Nice.
Whether or not I come through with it is up in the air.
Okay.
But yeah, CEO, I have some money. I have some push.
Yeah, big damn deal on that one.
Yeah, and I had fun. I had a ton of fun. I was also like 40 or 50 pounds heavier than I am now in that film.
Was that a suit or did you
no,
put it on?
No, I said what I had. This was where I was.
So you're coming off COVID. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's all, this is the therapy session right now. There, that's the streamline through this. It wasn't George Tolles. It was my weight, the things, COVID.
To fully encapsulate yourself in a character, it's one step away from method acting almost all the time.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's something to that. Well, the way my wife reacted to me doing another play says that I probably play a lot in this world. I do love Stanislavski's theories. I love all of those. Even all the branches, Stella Adler. I can't remember. Meisner and one more. Anyway, sorry, Glenn Odero. Because he keeps reminding me that I Strasbourg. He keeps reminding me that I kind of teach in the Strasbourg way.
Sure.
Yeah. So I don't encourage it, though. I think the only... So why I use it, why I think it's important, is to kind of keep yourself in the zone, to keep yourself present, grounded, and not allow yourself to be distracted from all of the technical stuff that's going on.
Yes.
I think that's...
But it's not carte blanche for being a dick.
That's right. Right. No, it's just a powerful tool you can use if you are having difficulty staying in character. Like if they're doing four or five takes and, you know, after take two, you're done because you can't focus anymore. I think method is maybe a great way to kind of keep you grounded and present so that you can do the amount of takes that they need, because they're going to need different frames, different sizes. But if you don't have a sound mind or you're fragile in any way, I don't encourage it. I think it's not really good to stay too long in an idea like that. It's just
vacation.
I mean, it causes things.
Yeah. You see the other side, and sometimes when you look into the abyss fucking bites back.
I read a couple of things. Maybe it was Charlize Theron who talked about it.
God, that woman could kick the shit out of me. I love her. Let her happen.
But she was on Smartless.
Yes.
And
such a good show.
I think they were talking about her characters and her method, and she said, you know what, before she had kids, she was all for it. But as soon as she had children, she realized she was a mother. She's like, I can never do that again. I cannot abandon my kids by, you know, selfishly going into some character to tell a story. So there's a lot of things that you need to kind of, if you're going to go into that, you need to do your research.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do it for a reason and make sure that your world is set up that you're not going to, there's not going to be collateral damage. Because it does, it creates it.
You hear The Man. Right, you hear Daniel Day-Lewis refusing healthcare on Lincoln because they didn't have this healthcare back then.
Correct.
Okay, man, I get that staying as Lincoln and talking like Lincoln is something that you want to do all day long and you want to be referred to as Mr. Lincoln, and I will do that.
And that's him just trying to get closer and hopefully kind of refine something that
But now your health and your bond are in question.
Sure.
Now the production, now everybody else's job is in question.
Correct.
Because you're risking the story for the sake of a character. You're missing the target, essentially.
So understanding the sacrifice, and I would argue that Daniel Day-Lewis understands the sacrifice he's making for these. And this is why he doesn't do film after film. He's not...
He's a 10-year break guy.
Yeah. Right?
He's like Radiohead of movies.
Yeah.
You know, always known, will come. I bet you they can get him off the couch. I bet you
he's not on the couch. I bet you, because I think the last time he'd stepped away, he was going to move to Italy to learn how to become a cobbler.
Yeah, maybe he's going to be a cobbler.
Well, you know, maybe this is an extension, too, of the craziness that's, again, but it sounds romantic and interesting to me.
It does.
It's like, I'm going to go learn a skill other than acting that is, you know, thousands of years old and is a artistic craft in its own.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
I saw Prince's Shoe House.
Okay.
It turns on, music pumps, videos start playing, interviews are happening, there's a piano, and it's just shoes. And it's like he actually got to the point where he wanted to learn how to make his shoes. He would show up with his three shoemakers and be like, tell me what you're doing, how are you doing it, right? And I'm like, that's a guy who's really married to his craft.
Yeah.
Sorry, cobbler, shoes.
No, Prince. I love it. Creativity. I mean, again, this is a long debate. Again, for me, it's about mental health. If you're challenging your own mental health, if your world is crashing around you, and again, collateral damage of the people that you are going to need for the journey.
Yeah, yeah.
Then maybe Maybe I'm talking myself out of something.
Don't worry, we're not that big.
I don't think I get enough opportunities of these big types of roles like All My Sons, where I'm in any danger yet.
Yeah.
Unless, you know, this life changes.
Good yet. I like that you finished with yet.
That's an important one. That's another buzz.
Yeah.
That's another self-help buzz.
It's not over yet.
Yeah, that's right. I'm entering a foray of directing a short film, a MIP.
Yeah.
It's called Dinner Date.
First of all, tell Manitoba, because that's where our fantastic fan base lies.
Yeah.
What are MIPs? Because I've seen 3 years of MIPs, and I think they're fantastic, and it's fun.
Yeah, as an actor member, I think maybe 7, 8, 9, 10 years ago. Anyway, because a lot of actors weren't getting the opportunities to grow, to learn, we created this. It's called a member-initiated project.
Yeah.
And what this allows people to do in the community, as long as they're actor members, excluded from technical. I mean, there's not a lot of actors who know how to do all the technical.
Yeah, so the base has to be actors, and then everybody else.
But you have permission to use actor members, if they're interested, if they agree, to do short films. I don't think longer than 7 minutes. I think there's a time limit.
There is, some strict rules.
But yeah, you get to utilize actor talent to do short films, and that there's no pay. It's usually for food and then a percentage of ownership.
So you can do whatever you want if that thing does get picked up, turn into a feature or something.
Yeah, but then everyone's got to get that percentage that you agreed to at the beginning.
Okay.
So yeah, I'm shooting my first. I'm a director for hire.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Anita Dare is producing.
She's great.
Jeff Iami wrote it. I don't know if you know Jeff. He wrote for Less Than Kind and a lot of other things.
That's where I fell in love with Nancy.
There you go. Yes, Nancy Sorrell. Hi, Nancy. Anyway, so I'm doing that. What I'm learning so much so quickly is the amount of legwork that needs to be done, because I have a vision for it already. I have ideas, but I've been watching so many short films.
Who's influencing you right now?
Well, one of the leads at the front was Tim Burton. That was from Anita Dare. So I watched a few of those. I kind of settled a lot on Edward Scissorhands. I'm giving way too much away because you're gonna see stuff now. It's like,
I'm gonna see a quirky, very abstract world set in a contemporary setting. That's all I'm thinking.
Right. And so the other side of things, I've been watching just award-winning short films. So I haven't actually. It's R2-D2.
Yeah.
He's saying time's up.
No. He's agreeing with what you're saying.
Okay.
Says, good. Keep going.
Thank you, sir. So what were
Matt Mip being a director? It's insane. You have no time to do anything.
Yeah, there's just storyboarding, shot listing. I mean, all these things.
All the things you were in before that you're now in charge of.
Yes, that I'm in charge of to kind of create for the creatives who are helping me. It's so involved. It's incredibly involved. It's hours of work on the front end before you ever get started to make sure that everybody in the room has the same vision. That we're not wasting any time as much as possible.
Time literally is all you have.
Yeah. So I'm doing it. I'm I'm a producer on it. So it's coming out of my pocket. I'm not getting any. I'm like Guy Madden. I'm going to have to sell my collage. I'm going to sell his collage to pay for my film.
You make some sort of creative endeavor, I'll buy it and I'll throw it up on the last piece of. I got some room right there.
Okay. Look at that.
That'll be an original Darcy right there.
Okay. That's it. Sold.
No, I love those MIPs. They're really well done. Like, I encourage anybody who has now heard about this or has heard us that have gone to these, go to them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's your local talent making really fun, interesting, very moving sometimes shorts.
Yeah,
you can tell a lot in 7 minutes.
Yeah, no, it's a wonderful event, and I hope it goes on for a long, long time. It's opened so many doors for so many artists and actors to really learn how to make film. And our talent pool has gotten even that much better because of these MIPs existing and giving people opportunity.
You get to stretch your talent.
And doing exactly what I'm doing, too. I'm now directing, and I get to now appreciate what someone like Jeff Beasley does for a Hallmark movie. When I have such an amazing time and he creates this beautiful, fun set, I'm like, man, there's so much work on the front end that you do to make sure that happens. Like, he's got a crew, he's got people he works with, he knows how
planning,
to give everybody an idea
booking.
Of where it's going to go. And then we have a ball. It was the most fun I've ever had on a set. It's crazy.
Yeah, and there's, I wish we'd hear more about that.
Yeah.
More fun on set, because all of the dirty laundry always gets aired, and it's like, you know how many movies get made properly and people have fun and there's a very inclusive environment, like.
And typically that's because people are being asked to do jobs above their pay grade. And then there's a frustration because maybe the result isn't there, or there's no reception of what's being asked for, because there wasn't any enough preparation. I think that's typically the set where people just start losing their patience with each other.
And then it's in the air.
It's passive, because it goes down the chain at that point, right?
Yep.
The director's frustrated, so that the AD's frustrated, and then the second and third are frustrated, and then they're treating everybody a certain way.
Downhill.
Now the extras are the, you know, the biggest hassle in the world, and all of a sudden, like, the whole...
To get back to your point, the egg got dropped.
Yeah, the egg got dropped. Yeah. But to my point, I just think these opportunities where... You know, it's still out of pocket, but it's not like we don't need $100,000 to create it. It just gives us so much more insight and understanding and strengthens our skill sets, so that when we're asked to play these supporting roles, there's a confidence that we're walking in with. I know how this goes. I know how this works. I know what my job is by being this, like, whatever. I have three lines, but I know why I'm here, and I'm going to give it my all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's back to your point. Like, you got to sometimes know that your three lines may not feel as important to you, because that's a voice in your head, but to the entire endeavor, they're very important.
They are. Yeah. 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 And I think a lot of us lose opportunities because we say, oh, it's just three lines.
Yeah. Three lines that maybe turn into six that maybe are the best.
Either that, or you get to work with someone you'd never worked with before. I remember Carmen Kotick telling the story of Jodie Foster coming in to direct a couple of Tales from the Loop.
Oh, I love that. I'm so butthurt that didn't make it.
But she'd brought in a lot of people she already knew for that, for the main roles. But there was like maybe five, six one-liners, and including me. None of us came out for them, because I'm not going out for one line. But then I do have a friend who got a role for one line, and he couldn't stop talking about getting to watch Jodie Foster do her thing.
Yeah.
Like, what an opportunity. You get paid to sit on a set and say one line and perchance be in a Jodie Foster project. But we all pass on it just because we have that idea that, oh, if it's not more than six lines, I'm not going to work as an actor. That's not going to further my career.
Yeah, that's the free market of it all, right? Like, there's a lot of opportunity and a lot of choice out there, but which ones are the right ones? And like you said yes to everything.
Too much. This is one of the most craziest weeks of my 2024. It's not the craziest.
I appreciate you fitting me into it. I really do.
I'm incredibly grateful to you. I really am. Michael, it's so good to meet you. Just doing my homework and listening to your show, you have a fantastic podcast. You're a little bit of a nerd.
Yeah.
But I kind of adore it.
Before I let you go, okay. I did say that I wanted you and me to talk about something that we're both watching right now.
True Detective, right.
And I want to get your take on it for a few minutes before we peace out of here.
Okay.
The creator, Nick Pezzolotto,
yep.
did the first four seasons, is shitting all over this season. And he's been removed and pulled back to EP on it, I think because he was too overworked. I think he wrote and created that show on. He didn't have a writer's room. Yeah. And after 4 years of trying to write new content for HBO, I mean, you do get to a point where I think...
There's
a burnout,
of
right?
Of course.
And so they gave it over to this new lady, Issa Davies, I think her name, Issaa.
I think that's right, yeah.
Wrote it, directed it, and created the whole thing, and is fucking killing it.
Yeah, I love it.
How... is this a family watch? Is this just a you watch? Like,
Christina and I have been getting into it. You know, one of the things that drew me in, the frozen scientist.
Yes, yes.
As soon as I saw it, I was like, holy shit, they borrowed that from My Winnipeg. That's the frozen horses, dude.
Oh, shit. Like,
the amount of detail in their, like, they're like all these, like, they're dying.
Somebody needs to make a phone call.
No,
just say thank you.
I love it as an ode. I love the characters. I'm really adoring, by the way, the amount of Indigenous stories that are out in the market right now.
It's getting it's starting to move.
It's making
needle.
My heart swell. It's
well, Little Bird got all that traction last year on
right.
HBO.
Acting Good was it's,
acting
it's hilarious.
Good. Bobrovskis is a fucking he's such a sweetheart.
I know. I just even going as far as Scorsese with the Killers of the Flower Moon.
Yeah, the Osage.
And then this True Detective North Country. There's a very strong proponent. I mean, I know some of the people are from outside of it, but they're bringing that culture into it too.
This is more of the in I don't know. Inuit story.
Inuit.
Yeah. Like the true northern
right.
snow.
And this
survivors.
this is by no means like a great example of it. I'm not saying that, but I just there's tones that they're bringing in now.
Yes.
They're willing to tell stories inside of that very dark tragedy that's very hard to unravel.
Oh, good Lord.
And gosh, that's just my personal opinion, but my heart swells watching these products and
Reservation Dogs
is just incredible.
Right.
Like, if you haven't seen it, it's
Shorzy is doing it.
Yes, that's right.
Right? Like it's like, oh yeah, okay, of course, if you're playing in the Northern Ontario Hockey League, you're going to have Indigenous people on your team.
Of course.
And the three gyms are fucking priceless. Yeah. They're the best part of the show. Right? Yeah, Jim. All right, Jim. No problem, Jim. But no, True Detective is I swear by the first season of True Detective is one of the best seasons of television.
It was the best
made.
Part of the pandemic.
For you, yeah.
For me, yeah.
And the fact that we still don't know if they're brothers or maybe cousins.
Do you think that's why he's upset that she's trying to bring...
that's what he's upset about.
Yeah, Cole's family, they're trying to tie that story together to the... Because I think I read that when that thing came up, that was impossible because... Russ Cole's story was fabricated in order to kind of get out of something.
So Russ Cole's story was fabricated to get him out of the undercover work he was doing in the motorcycle gang.
Right.
His uncle or grandfather, I can't remember which one it is, was stationed in Alaska.
Mm.
So it's just a family member that he does mention that was stationed up there and he did some time in Alaska. I think he did his time in Alaska after they tried to get him out of the motorcycle gang.
Right.
The connection is just that Rustin Cole's father is involved. He thinks it's the low-hanging fruit, right?
Right.
Tie back to the first season, the season that everyone loved.
With the tattoo, the swirl tattoo.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. I love that.
Me too.
I think that's fantastic because you're recognizing where we all came from. And there was supposed to be, I heard at one point, there was supposed to be a through line with all these cases.
Right.
Finally, we're getting that.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Jodie Foster
is incredible.
This right wing.
Yeah, racist. Like
shit heel of a human.
With a daughter who is
Indigenous.
Is Indigenous. And
stepdaughter, but like even.
And is trying to kind of connect to her roots.
Right.
And getting like abused for doing it.
There's so much going on besides the main story that keeps you interested. And Casey Davis, the one playing opposite Jodie Foster.
Oh, yes.
The local cop.
She's the boxer, right?
She's the box. She's the MMA fighter.
Yeah, that's right.
She's got a really good record, too. Like, she's like fuck around and find out kind of fighter.
She looks tough, but she's fantastic in it.
She's so great in it. Like, I think she's got two or three other credits to her name. So being able to work across the thunderous presence of Jodie Foster, mm-hmm. I mean, that's got to be intimidating all on its own.
And she's holding her own.
The shots, the coloring. Like the ice blues, and just like the fact that it plays into the 30 Days of Night. That's one of my favorite vampire movies.
Right. That's right.
There's no more sunlight.
Such a great concept. I'm really digging it. Yeah, and I again for me it was just wow. They're borrowing from us. That's cool.
Yeah, there you go.
I mean, I'm probably just making that up, but I believe it.
It's fucking fact now, man.
Yeah, it is.
How many frozen heads out of 10 do you give True Detective so far?
Yeah,
frozen horse heads.
Frozen horse heads. I give it so far I'm going to give it 7 out of 10.
Yeah.
Yeah, cuz I don't get to see it till the end, and you know, that's important.
Yes.
It's got to arrive.
You need the third act.
Yeah.
You need the ending. Totally. Yeah, I get it.
But I'm loving it. I'm just engaged with it.
Mm-hmm. Everything that's going on in your world right now, I want you to send me all the links for it. So the audition stuff for Guy Madden and all the information about the play, it'll all be in the show notes.
Okay, great.
So no matter who trips over this episode, which we know everybody in Manitoba who loves the show will, they're going to know when to come to see the play.
I'm going to manifest that we get at least 1,000 listeners for this one.
I like that.
Is that good?
That's good.
Okay.
That's a good number.
Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah. You might be the biggest number out of anywhere. And none of us have ever said that. We've never said this episode's going to do this or this episode's going to do that. So now that you're putting it out into the world,
it has to happen.
Yeah. I'll put a reverb on that so it just keeps going. going. That's in the close. 1,000.
There you go.
Is there anything else you want the people to know before I let you go?
No, I'm so good. You guys got way more than you needed of me. And I appreciate it. If you guys listened, thank you. I love you all. I love this city. It's, I may leave it at some point, but that'll be after retirement, just so I can see other things. I'm a very fortunate dude, and I'm very grateful. I'm grateful to you, Michael.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Listener, thank you so much for tuning into another episode. If you haven't got your tickets yet, Tuesday, the 13th, we're live at Rudy's, 7 o'clock to 10 o'clock. Tickets are on Eventbrite right now. $15 a ticket. Subscribe to the show. That's all we ask you. It's the easiest thing you can do to support us. It's free. It's easy. It's on every one of your podcast players. If you've gotten this far, you owe me. You owe me a subscription if you've listened this far. Say bye to everybody. There's
later, everybody.
Bye. Watch all the movies, kids.
Good afternoon, good evening, and good night.